The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our author event series, recorded live at the Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, the Central Library Expansion Project, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org. Thank you very much for coming today. We are at capacity, so we will need you to be... If there are any seats, please put your hand up so that we can get folks in. Okay, so it looks like we've got about 10 more seats. Just so you know, our time is very tight today. So with regard to the Q&A, it's going to be fairly limited. If you would keep it to specific terse questions, that would be very helpful. That way everybody will get a chance. My job is to be the bad cop. Bob and Lee Woodruff had it all. Lee was a public relations executive, and Bob was the co-anchor of ABC's World News Tonight. Then, as all of you know, Bob was seriously injured while embedded in Iraq. Their book, In an Instant, is the frank account of how Bob and Lee's lives came together, were blown apart, and put together again. Today, they will be interviewed by 6ABC's Matt O'Donnell, who is the weekday morning anchor for Action News. Please welcome Bob and Lee Woodruff and Matt O'Donnell.
Thank you. You didn't have to stand. I almost feel like I have to stand because I just had a cheeseburger and one of those big lemonade drinks. It was delicious. Bob and Lee, it's so great for you to come to Philadelphia and talk about what is a fascinating book. I was telling them in the green room, which was actually white, that I read it in about a day. It's a wonderful story about multiple things. Not only what happened to Bob, but what happened to his family, what happened to many soldiers in Iraq. It's a love story, and it's about someone who is living his dream. He became a journalist. So I encourage you to read it. But today we're going to talk about it. Bob, maybe the first question I'd like to ask you this afternoon is, what is it like to have more than 30 days of your life missing from any sort of memory?
Well, certainly at the beginning of this, after I got hit, I don't remember any of the time that I was in a coma for 36 days. I don't still have any memory of that. Even some of the time after I first woke up, I don't remember the first several days. The one that I do remember is when Lee walked into the room, and she walked in after all this time, every day, day after day, coming to help me. And I said, "Hey, honey, where you been?"
And I had an answer for that.
So, yeah, I filled with guilt, you know, from that moment. But for some reason, at that time, I just couldn't believe how lucky I was to have not only her, but my friends, my brothers, her sisters, my parents, her parents, friends from all of our neighborhood. People that I worked with, friends that I hadn't seen, some of them in years, just coming to help. And to this very day, it's just one of the most lucky moments that I've had in my life, which is the people that have been able to come and help. And I think that's really helped for so many of these that have been injured generally in this in the war or even in this country with anybody with the same kind of traumatic brain injury or anything else. This would be wonderful if more people get that kind of reaction. And I had my wife, and she was in control. We know we called her the general anyway, so.
I think you called yourself that, too,
right? I called myself the general. Yeah, Bob's always changing the story. and now this nickname has stuck for me around the house. And I said, no, you don't understand. That's what I was inside my head, okay?
Catherine, your daughter, one of your daughters, may have been the first person to provoke any sort of response. I remember reading how she touched you, or perhaps you heard her voice, even though you were in that state, and you started to cry.
Yeah, there's a game that we've played for most of our lives. This is my young 13-year-old daughter, Catherine, who's talking about. During this time while I was asleep, the doctor would come up, and even other members of my family would try to talk to me and try to get me to wake up. And there was never any reaction from me. But at one moment, my little daughter, Catherine, came up to give me some kisses on the side of my cheek. And apparently, and Lee could tell the story better, that suddenly a tear broke out of my eye. Apparently, I understood that was her and was starting to react to that, even though I don't remember that either.
Lee? That's exactly what happened. We were looking for any sign of any recognition. What they want you to do when you're in this medically induced coma is to follow commands, they call it. So they want, when they say, Bob, squeeze your hand, they want him to squeeze, or Bob, open your eyes. And nothing was happening. They were getting no reaction from Bob. And Catherine, I think, saw Bob on the second week. We were sort of waiting for him to wake up before we brought the kids in, but we were realizing that he wasn't waking up, and the kids really needed to see their father, as dire as that sight was. And Catherine walked in the room, and it was quite a grim sight. Bob's skull, half of his head, his skull had been removed, and his brain was swollen out the top of his skull. And the IED, which went off only about 15 yards from Bob, had blessedly hit most of the underbelly of the tank, but grazed completely the left side of his head. So his eye was closed. I was sure he had lost the eye. His ear was completely mangled, and his left side of his face was, I think I say in the book, was as if someone had tied him to the back of a truck and just dragged him by his face. And so my brave little daughter took everything, I could feel it in her toes, took every ounce of energy she had to walk in that room and see her father like that. And she went around to what we called his good side and gave him the kiss, because the kissing game was a game that she would play when Bob was on the road covering a story. She would always want her daddy to tuck her in on the phone. So they had a game where they would kiss on the phone, and the first person who needed to come up for air and break the kiss was the loser. So she said to him in the bed, Daddy, let's play the kissing game. Of course, he couldn't respond, but after she was kissing his cheek a few times, we saw a tear, and we called the nurse in so that she wouldn't, a lot of times family members see what they want to see when someone's in a coma, and we called her in, and sure enough, she said that to the, explained to the doctors the next day. That was my first sign of hope that Bob was there and that there was something in there. Now, later, and this is not in the book, I said to them, they said, he's still not following commands, and this was at the end, slightly before he woke up, when they were starting to talk to me about putting Bob in a nursing home. And they said, he only seems to react to you, because I would come in and he would turn to me and you could see him move more when he would hear my voice. And the neuropsych woman, who was very military and very regimented, said, you clearly have him very deeply trained in the recesses of his brain. Because I looked at her, I said, could it not just be true love? And she sort of looked at me like, yeah, sister, nice try. So I liked to look at it with my own glasses on, frankly.
Let's talk about what got you there, Bob. You were covering a war. You were the anchor of ABC's World News Tonight.
For 27 days. Yeah.
Exactly. For people that maybe don't understand, why were you there? Why did you have to be there in Iraq?
Well, there's many reasons. I mean, I'd been over in Iraq 7 times since 2002, twice when Saddam was still there, and then I was there for 5 times, including this one, since the beginning of the wars. And I just believe strongly that if you wanted to learn something about Iraq and what was actually going on over in Iraq, whether the positive or the negative aspects of it, that you really need to go there and see it for yourself. And there was the president was about to do a speech, and Elizabeth Vargas was going to go report from D.C., and as the other anchor, I really desperately wanted to go to Iraq and see exactly what was going to be raised and what was happening. And so that meant to go out with the Iraqi military to see how the U.S. is passing some of the power over from the U.S. military to the Iraqi military, and that was just very important to me, not only to see them and talk to them, but also to go out in their vehicles and things and see what they did. And we used the U.S. military to protect us, because that's largely what's happening in the journalism over in Iraq now is you've got multiple ways to get around, but nothing like it was before, all the way up until probably the mid of 2004, when the journalists could actually travel around the country like we did. We'd go travel from Baghdad all the way down to Basra. We'd check into hotels. We'd go to a restaurant, interview Iraqis on the streets. And now it's really far too dangerous for that. So the way to really go around and see things that are happening, you can either go out with the U.S. military to some degree, as they got some protection, and the other thing is to maybe send some Iraqi journalists around to try to talk those interviews and use the information that they get. But this was my way to do it, was to go out with them. We just, in this situation, got unlucky.
The what ifs. You were standing up in the tank when this happened. How do you get past the what ifs, Lee? What if he wasn't there? What if he was 200 yards away from where this bomb went off?
That's a great question, because I tortured myself with that, as I think anybody who's been in a tragedy or who's watched their child dash out in front of the car, or that moment where you just think it's all about the timing sometimes or the luck. And I don't think I got past it until Bob said two things. And when, by the time he woke up, I was still beating myself up over what if you'd just been down, because Bob had been popping up and down in the tank during that whole, it was an all of 10-minute ride, I think, supposedly, that it would have been. And he'd been up and down, and Vivi, the cameraman, Doug's wife, Vivi Vogt, and I would say to each other, like, you know, why weren't they down just at that moment? And when Bob woke up, and I just said to him, you know, I can't stop playing that image in my mind. And Bob said, well, what if I had been turned differently, or I'd been in a different position or whatever? It could have been so much worse. And he framed it positively, where I had looked at it so negatively. And he was so lucky to be alive when he woke up that began to recede the what ifs.
Talk about your recovery, Bob. When you woke up, you really don't remember that moment, correct?
No, just that one memory that I've got when Lee walked in. And then I've had strange dreams in some of the days after that, which you can probably see in the book, but not many. That's true. In fact, I didn't really have much fear at that moment. I had a chance to now talk to my friends, and I felt, you know, relatively happy. But in terms of what I remember, I think certainly they're getting better every day. But I still can't remember some of the things happened to me in the first couple of months, just here and there.
And today?
No, today it's, you know, the thing about my brain, since I got hit in the left side of my head in this is largely language. Words, a lot of names of my friends, names of places, words generally in the English language I don't really know very well. I mean, some of them I've forgotten. But I understand all of the things that are happening. I understand what's happening in these places. I just can't get literally the words out sometimes. I mean, you can see a huge difference between it was 8 months ago, 4 months ago. I would not have been able to even do a speech here with you, or any kind of talk like this to you even that long ago. And hopefully this will continue to keep going over the next, I don't know, maybe half a year, if not decades. The doctors have said that generally it's between 1.5 years to 2 years to get better in your traumatic brain injury. I'm sure there's probably here people, I know they met one already, with traumatic brain injury. This is, in this country, you get 1.5 million people every year get TBI. And there's an understanding from some people that don't really know much about it, that they believe this idea that it's 1.5 years to 2 years. But doctors really now believe now that it's probably much longer of time, maybe even decades. And hopefully that continues.
You write in the book that, quote, I will never be the same. Now, is that in terms of recovery, physically, mentally, or is that because of what happened being so traumatic, or a combination of both?
The doctors say you'll never be 100% the same, but I used to be a real jerk. I'm not going to be that anymore. So some of it's very positive.
Okay, you guys wife, all heard that, right? So the next time he throws his underwear on the floor, I can call you off.
No, I use this as an excuse now. If Lee wants me to clean up the basement or something, because I can't go down there, I've got TBI. So, you know, you can use it one time here and there, don't you think? Yeah. Yes, exactly.
Cognitive deficit. I think that the answer to that is very complicated, because I was just asked that question by a woman I was at a forum, and there's the model Petra Nemkova, who lost mm-hmm. her boyfriend in the tsunami and clung to the tree for a day, and now has started this amazing foundation to help all kinds of people, not just the tsunami victims. And she said, if you had a magic wand and you could use it for one thing, what would it be? And I had to think about that for a minute, and I said, I would turn the clock back to the day before this happened. As rich as this experience has been in some ways, and all of the good that we hope to do to all of the wounded and all of the people with brain injuries in the civilian world, it changed us all. I mean, my children discovered the side of life I didn't want them to see yet, that I would have loved to have protected them for just a few more years. They saw me in a situation of lack of strength, and they saw their father in a debilitating situation, and they were fearful, and we were all afraid. And I think that changes you into a different kind of person. There's a wonderful saying about in order to make fine china, you need to put the clay in the highest heat possible. And I'd like to think that our family has come out to sort of be the Limoges of, you know, families that have gone through tragedy, but I wish it hadn't happened.
The extent of Bob's treatment has, in the book, you say, it makes you uncomfortable at times because you know that not everyone, particularly people in the military, received that. Talk about what, and Lee too, what you noticed during your stay trying to get better and seeing the other military members and what they're going through.
Well, you know, there's so many differences between those that are injured. It really depends on what happens. I mean, some of it is luck with my situation where, you know, one of these rocks went all the way through my jaw down here and went to the artery on the other side of my neck back here. And some amazing reason it just stopped 1 millimeter short of it, hit right against it. It didn't. That would have killed me in about 20 seconds. That didn't happen. Those other rocks went flying in front of my left eye, and they're still stuck right inside my nose right here. Why that just missed my eyeball by that much? I've got other ones that all went crushed my teeth and things over here. That's they got them, but they didn't do much worse than that. And the other ones that hit me in the shoulder back here that went in and stopped just short of my heart. Why that stuff? That's part of the reasons why I'm here now. But it also the medically. The advancements are remarkable. I mean, they flew me. Once I got hit, I got in a helicopter, flew all the way down to Baghdad, then up to Balad, which is just north of Baghdad. And within about 37 minutes, I was with these doctors. And then within 2 hours, they're taking my skull off. That's something that would not have happened in the previous wars. I mean, they have been so masterful at this kind of thing because they see so many IED explosions now. They now have figured out what to do. I mean, if I had this kind of situation in Philadelphia, they wouldn't know specifically exactly what happened to your head that might be bleeding at them, and they don't know exactly what to do. They have to look at things. Sometimes it would have taken multiple hours, if not even a day or so, before they took my skull off, and at that point, I would have not have improved as much as I have now. So that part of it is really remarkable. But then the kind of rehabilitation... There's a little tiny bit of word being forgotten there for a second. Rehabilitation, then later on, that's the kinds of aspects of this we really need to fix in terms of what we're doing for these military guys when they come back, because, you know, we have been... I think we're starting to make a little bit of movement on it. I think, truthfully, a lot of us in this country generally, whether we're from the government to just ordinary people like us, knowing about what was happening with the militaries in terms of long period help from the VA, for example, just didn't really understand it or didn't know about it. And now we do. And if that what happened out of this, then I think that will be positive.
You know, and I'd also like to say, because I was the one that was there and awake for most of his acute care. So when he got to Bethesda Naval Hospital from Germany, and in Germany, or those that get to Walter Reed, That is the highest level of care. It really is. Those doctors and all of those medical people are astounding in what they do and how they love our soldiers and care for them and our Marines. And I think everybody there gets the same care and love. I really do. I think the problem for the brain injured in this war is that after that, when they're in the outpatient stage and they're going back to their homes, which are in far-flung places, many in smaller towns, many in the South, where the VA may not be so strong. In private rehab hospitals, people have made lots of advancements with head injuries because of automobile accidents, sports injuries. But in the VA, they're largely focused on aging veterans. The last real war where they had to deal with issues was Vietnam, truly. First Iraq War really didn't result in that many injuries. And in Vietnam, people that had Bob's kind of injury didn't make it out. Or if they made it out, I remember one general from Vietnam telling me, it was probably 90 days. You did your recovery over there. There was no means to transport you. So that's the part that we all have to fix, is the VA part of this. And again, those are wonderful, loving people. It's not the people, the places. It's the system. And the system is broken and underfunded. And this is not how we need to treat these men and women who are there for our freedom.
Bob has been all over the world. It's probably not too many cities you haven't been to yet in your career. And that's tough on a woman who's trying to raise four children and has a career of her own. And in the book you talked about how sometimes you just wish that Bob would be back home. And then this happens, and he is. And do you ever stop, Lee, and say, I wanted him back, but not this way.
Be careful what you wish for. You know, I think you touch on one of, to me, the most crucial parts of the book, in a way, is, and it's the part that I am was so at first surprised about and so grateful for, is when people come up to me and say, thank you for being so honest, because I think it would have been very easy to write a book that glossed over everything and made it sound like, you know, we pulled up our bootstraps and we all recovered. And the best marriages involve a lot of compromise, and the best marriages include resentment at times and all of those things. And I think I think that to portray that honestly does everyone a service, because there's an awful lot of women who understand that they're still married after 20 years or 30 years, but there were periods where maybe it wasn't so grand, but in the end, that those periods and getting through them together and working it out in the end, as Bob and I always have, is probably the greatest expression of for better or worse. So I feel blessed to have a man by my side who looked at life every day and said, I'm still lucky to be alive. I may not be on TV, but I'm still lucky to be alive. So.
But let me just tell you about the general right here has already told me I can't go to Iraq anymore. Which she never really did before, about limiting where I can't go. So, but this is the first time I've been a long time to Philadelphia, and considering it never rains or is cold here, it's just nothing but beautiful and sunny, I love this town.
Bob, could you tell the story of when you were looking at the pyramids in Egypt and you called home?
Yeah, we were over there in 2002, right before we were getting the understanding that the U.S. was probably going to go after Iraq at that point, so we were over in Cairo, and yeah, I did go out to the pyramids and was riding on, I don't know, some kind of horse. And I called Leah back at home and I said, honey, I'm here in front of the pyramids riding it on a horse. You know, this is right between working and not sleeping for weeks, okay? But this wasn't constant like that. And she complained to me.
I don't think you're filling in the whole story, boyfriend, okay? Let's just say this was my ninth move with this joker over here, okay? And I had twins that were three, and all the boxes were coming in with the burly moving men. And I was trying to sort out school forms and figure out where furniture went alone. And someone calls and says, guess where I am? And I think, oh. And he said, I'm at sunset at the pyramids on horseback. And I said, oh, really? Guess where I am right now? And I think he shut up pretty quickly. Yeah. You left out that little part, huh?
Well, here's the problem with the book, okay? You know, we originally had, we'd written about 950 pages for this book, and we cut it down significantly to 288 pages. And so all of this stuff about all the terrible things that I did here and there sometimes to my own wife are now reduced, so now it looks like it happens every other day. So I don't believe that.
She said it was honest, so.
Yeah, exactly.
How are your children doing? And do they completely understand? And obviously this has changed them. How?
I think I have a great story for that, and it's about our little Nora, our twin. It was the year to the day of Bob's injury, January 29th, just this past January. And I had been anticipating this day because I knew I would have a lot of feelings about it, because I think sometimes anniversaries are more, they're memory embedded in our body, in our psyches, whether or not we want to admit it sometimes. And as I was driving our older children to school that morning, I just said, you know, just so you guys know, it's a year ago today. I know there are going to be news stories on it tonight. Maybe somebody will say they saw Dad on TV or something. I just want you to know that this was the day. And they kind of said, okay. And I told myself I would not tell the six-year-olds because I didn't think we needed to revisit that. And they must have heard me on the phone somewhere, because as I was tucking them into bed that night, our little Nora started to cry. And I said, why are you crying? She said, I'm just really sad about Dad. And I said, why are you sad about Dad? He's doing so well. He's doing wonderfully. And she said, well, he's just different. And I said, well, what is it about the new Daddy that makes you sad? And she said, well, he's got red stuff on his face now, and he used to have a really nice body, and now his back is all scarred. And she said, his hair sticks straight up now, and his head is an oval, she said. I said, I thought they did a pretty good job putting his head back together, but clearly they didn't get the shape right. And she said, and he doesn't always have all the words. And I said, you know, but Dad's getting all the words. It gets better all the time. And she said, but you know what? I think this new Daddy loves me even more. And that, to me, was okay.
Do you love life more? Do you love your children more? Is it... any father or any husband would say it's impossible, but any good
like I said, I'm not a jerk anymore. You know, I think there's no question that I was changed by this. I think there was, first of all, there are moments. The summer, for example, I was with my kids on vacation, basically, for 7 weeks. Now, as you know, Matt, better than anybody here about this job sometimes, you get called away in the middle of a so-called vacation. I mean, we literally just had our first vacation in about 4 years where I haven't been called away or wasn't able to go, or maybe Lee would have to go alone with the kids someplace.
And I don't think that's funny, by the way. I heard that little chuckle.
But this year I decided to, you know, be with Lee because I love her so much. But yeah, so I've had that ability to get back with my kids more. I mean, I was filled with guilt about what I did to my family. I mean, I do to this day. I still feel that I somehow did this to them. And, you know, lucky that we made it to the extent that we have, but I felt badly about it. And spending more time with my kids and with my wife has certainly brought me closer to them. And I'm thankful for that.
We'll get to your questions in a moment. One final question I have is about the out-of-body experience. And you hear about this all the time. Tell us about what happened to you.
Yeah, what happened when we got hit? I mean, I could tell you exactly what. That's strange. Again, one of the strange things that I remember about it. I obviously did not feel the rocks and the metal from this IED hit me on the side of my head and in my back. Because what happens with these IEDs is they're so powerful that the air actually blows out hard in front of it, and then it's followed by the rocks and the metal. So I was knocked out right when the air hit me, so I didn't feel the pain. And I was out for 1 minute, and one of the things that I do remember is that I suddenly was just dreaming. I was just looking at my body floating underneath me in kind of a white area. And that lasted for about 1 minute, and that's all I remember of it. That's all I remember is me just below me kind of floating around, and that's all I can say. I don't have much more information than that. Sometimes I say hopefully another 45 years I can stay on this planet, and I'll know a little bit more then.
You mentioned you're not afraid of dying because of this experience. Explain that.
you know, from this whole time, even to this day, I feel comfortable about it. You know, I think the thing that I have with it is dying, leaving my children or my wife and those that are my friends and my parents and brothers and sisters and things without me. That part makes me afraid of dying. But what, for me, if I had none of those around, then I would be completely comfortable with it.
Your questions for Bob and Lee. We have one. And we have a microphone. Let me locate. Okay, now I see the microphones. That gentleman down there.
Yes, hello, Bob. I heard on one of your interviews that you came into this career like from a non-traditional background, and I was just wondering maybe you could give some advice for someone who's maybe interested in that. I mean, you hear about people getting into it like when they're young, but you were a little older. So I just wondering anything you would have done differently or any advice you would get.
Yeah, you were a lawyer when you
I was a lawyer before I got into this. I didn't become a journalist until I was 30 and had a brand new little baby and forced my wife and my family to then take a huge cut in pay from about, I was making like $130,000 a year as a lawyer. I was like, you know, rich as a dog. And then I took a job for $12,000 a year with this brand new baby and my wife and moved out of San Francisco and moved up north to Redding, California. I think you just realize sometime in your life, no matter what you're doing, that, you know, I need to do something that really means something to me, that is interesting to me. Forget about the level of pay and all that kind of thing. Just, I think one of the things that we probably learned over the years was no matter where you go and how much money you have, you'll have people around you that are pretty much the same as you and pretty damn good. And that's where you made your friends. And in terms of getting into journalism itself, though, I think you just have to somehow find it in you. And I, for some strange reason, when I was a lawyer, it got the market collapsed in New York in 1987, which then had me find a job teaching law in China, in Beijing. In 1988, we got married 2 days before we moved over to Beijing, and I became a translator for CBS at the end of that year when it just happened that Tiananmen Square broke out in 1989. And for some reason, after thinking about being a journalist, even before I went to law school, it just suddenly came possible for me to work in one of the most amazing stories that were happening in the world and probably had for a decade in the middle of that in a place where I'd worked on my Chinese and was able to use it to the point where I could use it for CBS. And I knew that that was the big difference for me and that's what I wanted to do. So that's when I quit the law and became a journalist. So, I mean, sometimes it's just luck where something happens that just tells you this is what you need to do because that's clearly what you like to do. But in terms of the techniques to become a journalist, I don't really know the trick except getting out there someplace and take yourself out on the street and start telling the story and see if you're any good at it.
Bottom line. Let me get another question on this side, if I could. You, ma'am?
Hi. I'm so glad to see how you're doing, but I thought I'd tell you a little bit. You didn't know if you would be getting better. I just want to tell you that almost 5 years ago, I had a severe stroke and brain hemorrhage. I'm almost 85 years old. I wasn't able to walk. I had to learn to walk. I'm still having a little problem with my talking. And I had to learn to... I'm just helping other people to give them encouragement. And if it wasn't for my daughter here, I don't know if I'd even be here. The doctor said I would never make it.
That's a great question for Lee. How do you make someone better? What was your role? What was most important?
I was determined.
This is for Lee.
Okay,
I'm sorry.
Lee. Okay, I'm sorry.
You know, all I can say is that I just surrounded him with love every day, every minute of the day, and I reached into my toes. And I had a stupid little song that I would sing in the morning because I would have to wake him up and get him to therapy. And his fake name was John Steele because we had to come up with an alias. And so I would walk in dancing and singing John Steele, and I can't sing. And that's why and I just thought, oh God, I have to sing that John Steele song again. But I'm just going to keep beaming love at him. And I think the whole family and the whole network did that. And I'm sure your daughter did that for you as well.
I was in the cabin for 6 weeks and in a nursing home for 3 months.
Well, you
I
know what?
I was in a cabin for 6 weeks and a nursing home for 3 months. So it does get a little better.
Miracles do happen.
You look great to me. Sound, your voice is
keep
perfect.
Keep on dancing.
Thank you, ma'am. Let me get a question down here, ma'am.
I'm very glad to hear you today. Thank you for coming. I'm very pleased also that you gave some credit to the VA for what they do well. There's always room for improvement. And I would hope that we can count on you to keep that issue in the forefront of the nation, because our vets certainly do deserve the best of care.
Bob, you, in fact, you have already done that. Your first report on World News after the accident was about this very issue. Talk about who you met and what you saw.
Before he answers that, I'd just like the second part of my comment.
Okay, do you have a question? Because we really would like to get questions.
It is a question.
Okay.
I'm very pleased that you were in the front lines reporting in Iraq instead of reporting from some hotel, even though the outcome wasn't real good initially. You were greeted here today with a round of applause, standing audience, and you are indeed, in my mind, that you had heroic behavior. But I would like you to compare what you did with what our soldiers and Marines and sailors are doing day in and day
out. Your question, ma'am?
I'd like you to compare what you did.
He's tough, guys. Do you watch ABC? Because you should. Yeah. I like him.
I alluded to this earlier, Bob.
You're asking about a war question about whether they're doing the proper thing there, or are they doing a positive?
I'm just saying, the soldiers are out there. My son was out there a year ago, the same place where the British sailors were apprehended, and he was dealing with the same Iranian Navy doing the same kinds of tricks. I would like to know what you, in comparison to what you did as a journalist, what do you think about what our soldiers and sailors and Marines are doing day in and day out, facing the same kind of tragedy that you
right.
endured?
You know, it's a lot of courage that they've got. I mean, these are the guys. This, you know, people have asked me many times, do you think it's right for us to go over and report in Iraq because it's so dangerous, isn't it? Isn't it kind of something that you should stop going over there to report because it's so dangerous? My question is, look at all of these Americans that are going to there right now and risking every day their lives. We should go over there. It doesn't have to be everybody. Like some journalist asked me, should I go to Iraq? I'd never say one way or the other, yes, you should or shouldn't do it. It's completely up to you to make that decision, and someone's got to return to report this. The families, like you, you said you've got a son? The families that are back here want to hear what's going on over there. They want to see them. They want reporters with them to report on what they're doing. And that's always what I've tried to do. I'll tell you one story which is absolutely remarkable. As an example, is after I got hit and I was in this tank, and they had to take me out of the tank and take me a mile down the street to get picked up by a helicopter to then be saved. They had no idea that the guys in the helicopter, the pilots that were coming down to pick us up, had no idea who we were. They assumed that we were military guys. Me and Doug Vogt, my cameraman, both of us had to be taken away. And the pilots came in and they got an order on the way in, because there was a gunfire going on between the Sunni that had attacked us and our military guys. And there was an order from his boss, basically, over the radio into the helicopter, and said, don't go down there right now. It's too much gunfire. And they actually turned down the radio, ignored the order, and came down and saved my life. This is what these guys did. And this is the kinds of things happening all the time. A lot of these ones you see that are injured, for example, in this war, a lot of times it's because they're doing to save their lives. I don't know if you read Martha Raddatz's book about what happened
in Sodder. The long road home.
Sodder.
Yeah.
You know, look at some of those stories of what these guys did, because they knew that some of their friends were under fire, and so they came in and did stuff to risk their lives to do this. You know, it is remarkable what these guys are doing in the situation that they have to go in. Some of them that completely behind it. They want it to be there, and others that don't, but they do this all the time, and that's what needs to be honored amongst these guys.
Can I just say two quick things? I know we're running out of time, but one is that even after everything that happened, you might be surprised to find that I still believe people need to be there. I believe we need to understand what's happening in this war.
Journalists.
Journalists need to be there, sorry, to cover what all of these brave men and women are doing. We need to make informed decisions when we vote, and we need to figure out what is happening on the ground there, and that's what Bob was trying to do. And that does make him a hero in my eyes. And the second thing about Bob continuing to report the story that's in the very back of the book, you can find our website for our foundation, but we started the Bob Woodruff Family Fund for Traumatic Brain Injury. And we are gathering money, and we're not reinventing a wheel, but we are taking a close look at organizations or individual soldiers who have needs, whether it be a fixture to help them drive because they have a new disability. Our big dream, and this we're in phase two now, as soon as we're off the road of getting corporate dollars, is Adopt a Soldier program. And I sat last night at the White House Correspondents' Dinner with the Joint Chief of Staff, and I said, okay, you're going to release those names of the wounded to us so we can get going? And he said, yes, come down to Washington and meet with me. We will talk to you. And that means that soldier's family that's coming back to a suburb outside of Philly, maybe it's your turn to get his wife groceries on Wednesday night, and it's your turn to take the husband who has a brain injury or an amputation out and hit a bucket of balls so she can get a bath alone by herself without being interrupted. And we can all come around and help these families reintegrate into the community, find jobs, support them, love them, surround them, give them money, whatever that may be. But that's our big dream with the foundation, and we want to make it happen.
Another question.
Could you please talk about Alan Johnson, the British journalist, and other journalists who are putting themselves on the line to do what you and others so importantly have done?
You talk about in Gaza, right?
Yes.
You know, there's been what's remarkable. What I think what's changed generally is that's a BBC reporter that was just killed in Gaza, or was it? He's missing. Oh no! Well, there was some news around that was being released out of Gaza that he had paid. But has that changed? I'm sorry, I don't have the information.
Okay,
he's not
him.
Well, that's good. But just generally, what's happening is what I started to tell you about my ability to travel around. For example, up until 2004, Pearl, of course, was one and also was one that changed this world a lot for journalists. Which is, I think, now people. Are now using journalists not to tell them the story like we did in Yugoslavia, for example, which I covered, where you could walk up to the so-called enemy and get interviews with them because they wanted to have stories to go out about what they're doing. That's how they would tell their story. Now a lot of what's happening is they're now capturing, kidnapping reporters or killing them because then they can use the internet, for example, and show this on there, and that would be show what they are doing in terms of what they're trying to accomplish. And that's what's changed. And I think, again, like I said before, I can't really recommend to anybody what to do, but I think there's things that we need to figure out how to avoid this kind of situations in our own personal lives. But journalism has to continue.
You know, there's a story, and I'll end with that because I think we're out of time. When Bob's body was on the CCAT plane, the giant transport planes, and some of there are varying degrees of injured soldiers being transported, and there happened to be a reporter there from the Boston Globe, and he told me this story that Bob was in the back, the wounded, very wounded were in the very back, so some of the soldiers who weren't as wounded came back to see Bob and Doug and just sort of, try to comfort them, and one of the soldiers who was a grunt looked at the doctor or the journalist next to Bob and said, why would these guys do this? They don't have to be over here. Why would they come and put their lives on the line? And the Boston Globe reporter said, because they're journalists, that's what they do. And that's what you do.
Yeah. In an instant, Bob and Lee Woodruff, thanks so much for being here in Philadelphia.
Thanks, Matt.
I encourage you to go upstairs. Bob and Lee will both be up there signing books if you care. And enjoy the rest of the day. Thanks for coming.
Thank you for listening to a podcast from the Free Library's Author Event Series. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information is available at freelibrary.org.